is their life on Mars.
Convinced ourselves that they were gone, but they were just hibernating.
Welcome back to Watchmen Minute, where we're examining the HBO Watchmen series one episode at a time. My name is Travis Bowe from Real Comic Heroes.
And I'm Eric Nash from Almost Famous Minute.
How's it going?
Hey, pretty good.
Well, we've been waiting, you know, better part of 2 years for last night's premiere of the new HBO Watchmen series. So I don't know about you, but I feel like it was worth the wait.
It would there's certain things I think that you know, are done awfully well, you know. Yeah. some effects type, you know, fight choreography stuff, you know, the crispness of the you know, the shot, you know.
Yeah.
It looks like a really good, you know. Yeah. Because I'm not used to watching stuff on HBO for quite a while.
I mean, okay.
I watched Sopranos. And that's really almost like the last thing I did.
Okay. Like a little bit up of to date kind of.
But yeah.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it looked great. So, so I guess if you're a new listener, you know who we are. Eric and I went through the director's cut of Zack Snyder's Watchmen 1 minute at a time. All those episodes are still available for your listening pleasure if you have never listened to them. You know, we invite you to go back and listen to the entire film 1 minute at a time with us. And now we're back to do it kind of do it again, except not going individual minutes this time, just one episode at a time. So thanks for coming back. If you have been a listener from the start, or, you know, thanks for joining us if you're new. So I guess I think we're just going to go through this kind of recap style and talk about, you know, things we found notable throughout the episode. And
sounds good.
Cool.
Do we want to start with the title, or do we get to the title when it's shown?
Yeah, doesn't matter to me too much. We can, mention it now as far as just being what it is, but I didn't know what the title was in reference to.
No, yeah.
So that was...
Yeah, it wasn't until my second viewing, really.
Oh, okay.
That kind of dug in.
So yeah, you watched this twice, you said?
Yeah. Yeah, and the second time with the captions on. I generally don't care to have captions on, but...
No, I
but
think
something
that,
like this.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Let's do this. And I picked up a few things, I think.
Cool. Yeah, I'm gonna definitely have to do that, you know, for the next episodes. I managed to get three viewings.
Oh, cool.
I watched it back to back last night. Yeah. You know, right after, you know, once when it as soon as it was available, I had it right at 9 p.m. Mm-hmm. And then I did a second viewing right after that, and then I got squeezed in one more viewing right before we jumped on the mics here. So, but no, the watching it with captions, the second viewing is definitely a good idea. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this is episode one, and it is titled, I think I would have had that in front of me. It's summer, and we're running out of ice.
And this is a very slight little tip of the hat to what we see, like, 10 minutes in, roughly, maybe, but it's summer and we're running out of iceberg lettuce. Huh. I'm just scratching at the bit there to try to get that joke in.
Nice. One of my first, you know, it starts out with this, you know, old timey, film being shown in some theater. And of course, you know, the obvious joke is you know, a black sheriff immediately made me think of, Blazing Saddles, of course, but you know, we find out that this is a silent film, and you know, it's got this black hooded figure, kind of reminiscent of a hooded justice, sort of. Mm-hmm. If you know, if you think about it that way.
Almost a cross with that and a Zorro type character is what I had in mind. They didn't want to do a cowboy hat that was black.
Sure.
Otherwise, that would be too on the nose, I think, for that.
And so I guess this is the Bass Reeves is who this guy is in this film, and a real person of historical note. He actually was a black sheriff. I mean, he was a sheriff in Oklahoma Territory. Back in it was the late 1800s through the early 1900s. And I remember, you know, I certainly found an article, I think on history.com. It was really interesting talking about him. And I had heard of Bass Reeves or the story, you know, the legend of you know, him, you know, being this kind of legendary lawman. But I would not have remembered, you know, the name, or didn't jump out at, you know, to me watching it that this was a real person. So definitely I'm glad obviously someone on Twitter, you know, shared that history.com article. So, cause it's his story is certainly worth, checking out. So then we see that it's this little boy is watching, you know, this, he must know the story pretty well, cause he's even, talking along with it there towards the end, talking about, you know, something about there'll be no mob justice today. And something about the law. How does he word it? About putting faith in the law, something like that. And instantly when I saw this little kid, you know, it certainly came across that this was in a much, much older time. So I thought instantly that this is going to be who Louis Gossett Jr. ends up playing.
Yeah. So yeah, I think by the very end part, we get a good clue that that's very, very likely the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be a little odd not to have it be, but
yeah. And I got to say, like, first time, you know, watching it, I wasn't familiar with the Tulsa riots, you know, that this is based on. I just kind of, you know, incorrectly assumed that this was just a, you know, I guess a fabricated sort of event that was happening, just to tell a story. But, you know, yeah, this is obviously it's been all over like Twitter and everywhere else. Just people pointing out, like, hey, this was a real event that did take place, and yes, the KKK did just wreak havoc all over this town in 1921, and they did have biplanes, and they were bombing, you know, buildings from the air and just shooting people in the street, and it's I found it really interesting that's where this show decided to kick things off.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah, to go straight from that old timey silent movie being played for essentially just this one kid by his, what turns out to be his mother, and then like you say, this bombing and so forth that happens. I mean, it's a little bit of an air raid siren type sound alarm that's heard, but then just a couple seconds in after that starts, you get the bomb that seems to like kind of blow a wall in the back of this theater.
Yeah,
and it really gets them moving.
I think on second rewatch, it felt a little odd that she would be playing piano. If it was hard to tell, did all the chaos outside just start happening once this air raid started happening?
Yeah, she might have known it was happening. Stuff was going on, but she wanted to kind of protect him with a favorite movie of his.
Yeah, I think rewatch, it just felt like you wouldn't be creating a lot of noise if you're trying to hide, you know? So I wasn't sure if it was something like if this just started happening, you know. She seemed upset and
Yeah.
She seemed like she was worried about something when, you know, they're at the tail end of her playing piano. And so it just, something I noticed, you know, I didn't notice obviously the first time because I didn't know what was coming. So, but not a huge thing. But yeah. Then they, the boy's parents kind of scoop him up and get him through this little town. And they've got some, I don't know, some kind of arrangement. Uh-huh. That seems to be falling apart once they get to this another couple who have a truck, you know, and they smuggle their son in this box and uh-huh. send him with this family.
Now this is a I think a reference to something else that I think you're probably very familiar with, but
okay,
I did happen to listen to two other podcasts today that. We're talking about the show,
okay,
the premiere show, and one of them said this, and I didn't quite catch what they were saying until just now. Your explanation of what's going on here, but this is the Superman scenario.
Okay.
Yeah. It fits now more than when they said it. It's like nah, but now I'm into it more.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. You know, sending the. Mm-hmm. Sending Moses down the river.
Yeah, right.
And sending that certainly, Superman there. In a rocket ship. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. Let's see. That's, yeah. Then cuts to black once the building he was in gets firebombed. And it cuts to black, and then he wakes up kind of in a field outside of town. Mm-hmm. And finds the couple. They're both dead, and then he hears the baby crying. It was this couple. They had a much younger child than this boy. Will Reeves. I think we find out his name. So of course he takes the little baby and kind of starts to walk out of town. And that's when we get the title card.
I have some thoughts on this baby.
Okay.
That it's, I think it's likely, and I kind of forgot about it after the first watch, you know, but upon the second watch,
sure.
I'm like, yeah, that, I think that, you know, could be, and there's something else to indicate this later, that this baby could be like, maybe like the grandparent-ish, or great-grandparent even, maybe, of our main character.
Okay. Angela it's Bond. Totally possible, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, because I don't recall if young Will's parents said the name of the couple. I think the mother says maybe the first name or
mm-hmm. Definitely like his father is OB. I know OB, I remember that much, but what it is later, I'll just go ahead and say it now, the older Will Reeves played by Louis Gossett Jr. Says, I think he's the one that's talking with her on the phone.
Oh yeah.
He says, I knew your father, Marcus Abar.
Okay. Yeah, then I could buy into this baby that he kind of then takes could be a relative of Angela who we'll meet soon here.
So we got Chekhov's baby.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought it was interesting, you know, this is this kid is, you know, his name's Will Reeves, and we just had him watching, you know, this movie of Bass Reeves.
Well, so I think that would be him taking on the name of Reeves.
Could be.
Because he knows it.
It could be that, or he could legitimately be one of Bass Reeves' descendants. So, I don't know if we'll find that out or not. Yep. But.
And that's another Superman
connection. What's that? Oh, Reeves, yeah.
Reeves.
Yeah. So we do get the title, you know, up on screen here, and they're doing kind of the same thing that the movie did with, you know, the title credits and all that stuff kind of being almost like a physical thing in the physical space. And there's
when it first popped up on that first viewing, I was like, wow, I mean, that's a billboard behind him. What the
hell? Yeah. Yeah. Cause they do the same thing with like Tulsa. 1921. It appears just like that before this, and then we've got the big title sequence. It's summer and we're running out of ice, kind of above Will as he's walking out of town, and then it cuts to see Tulsa kind of like on fire in the background, and then it fades to, you know, we'll find out in a second once the cop says the date that it's September 8th, 2019. Yeah. And we've got a cop, you know, doing this traffic stop, pulls this guy over in a pickup truck, and we can just, I like the way that it's shot, and they trust that if you're familiar with the subject matter, things like seeing the battery gauge on the truck will instantly make sense to you, and you'll understand that, yeah, this truck, even though it looks like an old mm-hmm. Ford pickup truck, is, you know, it's fully electric, because as of like the late 70s or certainly by 1985, like, there weren't any combustion engines, you know, running around in New York City. So it was all, you know, electric vehicles and everything. And that's continued, you know, all the way through 2019, that it's still electric vehicles. So I like that.
And there is the music he's listening to, this guy's listening to. It's
I think it's
called mumble rap.
Okay.
I don't listen to that genre of rap.
Yeah.
I haven't come across it and sought it out or anything, but, And the it's supposedly the artist, musician, what have you, Future.
Future, okay. I forget
the name of the song is, so I keep that.
Let's see, we got this whole traffic stop situation. Once you see the cop is, you know, asking for the driver's consent to be, you know, be filmed or recorded for this interaction. And he reads out the time, you know, it's like 9:35, September 8th, 2019, and then, you know, begins to question this driver. And I just love how intense it is. Like, just mm-hmm. right off the bat, it's got this intensity. It brings in some of our real world modern day, you know, misconceptions or fears or just the way, you know,
societal issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I just bringing in the recording your traffic stops, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. I think is very relevant to today, you know, and certainly is important.
It's all this stuff that's very, it seems like it's very by the book, you know, stuff going on. Yet we also have what comes up, what happens in a moment here. I mean, well, but he's not carrying a gun. I mean, this the guy he pulls over is so afraid of him, yet he doesn't have a gun on him. I mean, I would think that the guy would know that.
Right.
The guy getting pulled over. So.
Mm-hmm. I love the part, you know, where the cop goes back to his car and has to call in, you know, the request to get his weapon unlocked, which I thought was, I'm assuming that doesn't exist today. I don't think that's right. Happening. I don't know. I'm not 100%.
At least not in the U.S. Maybe there's somewhere else in the world where somewhere.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem that far off. Like, that seems like that technology could exist. I mean, it certainly.
Well, they have the guns that, you know, only can be shot with someone with the approved person holding it.
Yeah.
You know, via fingerprint and other stuff, I think.
But I really like the idea of, this cop having to get his weapon cleared to be released. And of course that causes a problem. And certainly he lets us know, kind of gives us the indication that, you know, when he calls it in and finds out that it's this panda who he has to get approval from, yet he doesn't, you know, that certainly, you know, doesn't make him happy, and he's got to deal with this panda guy who's we find out is very by the book, you know, kind of wants to go through the follow procedure throughout the entire thing, and that obviously leads to him kind of getting shot. I mean, at that point we've got the guy in the truck has gotten out and just lights him up, and you know, it's really well done. And you kind of expect it just because of this tense scene, but by the time he gets the gun, you kind of forget that this driver, that you got this tense situation, I think. So I think you get a false sense of security just for a second, mm-hmm. And that's enough to, for me, it was enough to get be surprised when this bullets start you know, blasting through this window. And I mean, if you think about it, the trailer we've, you know, recently watched, like they obviously talk about a recent shooting, you know, a cop involved shooting. So I think this is obviously what that is. And we've got the driver, you know, we see him in his Rorschach mask and certainly,
which was in the glove box, which I didn't quite catch the first time. And he mentions contraband in the glove box when he's talking with Panda. But I wasn't realizing it was his mask or his face. Now, one thing with the shooting of the cop through the window, making this big hole in the window, and then the thing that was previously talked about that the guy was supposedly transporting turns out to be at least partially true of being lettuce, and hence my little joke at the beginning.
So then is that when we cut to Oklahoma being performed at this little theater? And then we have Don Johnson's character, was it Judd Crawford,
right,
is getting informed. I'm assuming that there's a situation. He may find out here that there was a cop that was shot. So I'm not sure how much he learns when, but then it quickly cuts to... quickly cuts to the hospital.
But to go back real quick, his wife is sitting there. We hear later her name being Jane, and then there's two more blank seats, there's a little tip of a hat to something that happens later.
Sure. So. One thing it's striking, or that I find it really interesting when you're panning through this audience. At this theater, first you see the cast of Oklahoma is all black performers. And then most of the crowd is, I don't know, 90% African-American, like just a few, it just sticks out because I think in media, in at least in my, community, like you wouldn't see a room that's 90% black and then just a few white people. So it's interesting, and you kind of take notice of it, like, oh, okay, and it's not that it's weird. It's just caught me by surprise, and instantly showed me, like, okay, just, your assumptions aren't going to be, I don't know. Did you get any sense of that, or like?
Oh yeah, throughout. Yeah, I mean, this. I mean, well, I mean, it goes back to, I think, well, it's the white guy driving the car that's getting pulled over by an African American cop, but the white guy, the white guy is supposedly in with this, what we find out to be this white supremacist continuation of somewhat maybe kind of taking Rorschach's.
Oh yeah,
ideologies and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Into even worse directions than he ever kind of thought.
Yeah.
But the white guy was listening to this mumble rap,
Yeah.
So.
I thought that was interesting too, that for being part of a white supremacist group. Mm-hmm. And I took it that that's what he was listening to. I don't think it was just
it was diegetic. Okay. Yeah, cuz he turns it off and so
that's right.
It goes off at the same time.
Right. So anyways, we find out that, that Judd here is the chief of police, and at no point does he ever hide his face, we can definitely talk about the police wear masks, and that's going back to what began with Watchmen at the very start was people putting on masks to fight crime. And, it didn't start with Hollis Mason, but he was, I think, maybe the second person. He was inspired by Hooded Justice, and the people that he was arresting, they had to let him go because they were wearing masks and they were hard to identify. If the criminals are running around dressed as pirates and ghosts and whatever, they couldn't be identified easily. So that's when the cops at that point started wearing masks too and going out after being cops, you know, and still trying to take down bad guys. So I like that it kind of goes first full circle with the police putting on masks to fight crime, and then just ordinary citizens masking up, and then they become the, you know, criminals, and then masks become outlawed, and then here we have, you know, comes back around to where the police are wearing masks because it's now too dangerous to be a police officer, and, you know, your identity gets revealed, and, you know, now your family isn't safe. So I really like that idea of the police wearing masks. And that was one question that was brought up in our Facebook group about someone being confused. Christopher Heisel says that he was confused. You know, what was up with the police wearing masks? I thought masks were illegal. And yeah, here in this 2019 climate, it's too dangerous for police to be exposing their faces. And something that we'll meet Angela in a few minutes, and she is telling this room full of students that, you know, she was a police officer, and then when the White Night happened, you know, people, and I'm assuming that's an event that was some kind of event carried out by the 7th Cavalry, and the police weren't safe, and sounds like, you know, she was a victim of a home invasion where she got shot, you know, because she was a cop. So that's when it became, I guess, standard issue for police to wear masks. So
Now there seems to be some reference when you're talking about the White Knight, and I don't know if this is going to be the same thing or not, but there's some reference to something like when the cavalry was last active, seemingly was 3 years prior to this.
Yeah.
It's mentioned at one point coming up. But then another thing with the police wearing masks, it's the uniform officers. They all wear this yellow.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes all the way over, but other times, you know, their eyes showing seemingly.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have what I would call more your plainclothes police officers.
Right.
That aren't really plainclothes. They're superhero clothes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What we consider superhero clothes, kind of ish.
Yeah, more costumes, more theatrical. Yeah. Yeah. You when we see Panda, and then you have they just refer to
Panda's
him as
just
red.
Silly.
Yeah.
He's got that big old head.
Yeah.
When we see him here. But.
Yeah. Let's see. I think I jumped over Judd going to the hospital. That's where we first get to meet Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And just the obviously played by Tim Blake Nelson, and this is just a really interesting character that I'm excited to see a lot more of. I think everyone kind of is intrigued by this guy, you know, because you have someone who I think evokes a lot of Rorschach just because of the performance of a character in a full face mask, you know, and it's not, the mask itself doesn't have like this Rorschach effect, but it kind of does just because it's this chrome, you know, everything's reflected, and certainly later when we see him in the pod and there are actual Rorschach images on the screens and they reflect off of his face. So it definitely feels like you're seeing Rorschach again. And, but we see him with, Judd in the hospital, and I thought it was interesting. He says, cause this is just like, apparently there's a police run medical facility, and then this is just the normal public hospital. And so his first question is, you know, have the nurses and doctors, had background checks because they saw this Officer Sutton, the one who gets shot. They've seen his face, so now they need background checks on this hospital staff. So I thought that was really interesting. Let's see.
The one thing that's kind of mentioned right before we go into the next scene, though, still is that, and it comes up, it's a big bone of contention, kind of in a few minutes too, is that they don't call in Angela Barr's character, Sinister Knight, you know, they don't bring her in immediately. It's
right.
It's the next day, throughout the day, seemingly on her pager.
Yeah. And I guess,
and that's another thing, though, to mention also too, is that it was pointed out one of those other two podcasts I listened to is that you know, in this universe at this time, at least as well, especially, there's no internet or cell phones.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that was kind of
these pagers. You got the landline phones at their homes, but
yeah, I was thinking about that earlier, and I didn't know if I started thinking about the lack of internet, and I thought,
oh yeah,
if you know, as we know. Nixon was president for quite a while, and
apparently Ford. One point, it goes. The kids are at the dinner table. Are naming the presidents in order: Nixon, Ford, and then Rod Redford.
Yeah,
that's it.
I just wondered if you know, in that political climate, and obviously that that amount of, I guess, more of a right wing leadership. I mean, I don't know if. That led to the internet, and because we think of the internet as being this, like, it's freedom of information. It's very, you know, it's, I guess, a very liberal tool. I mean, it's a tool for both sides, no matter what. But I just thought, you know, is there a reason why the internet didn't become big? Was it being suppressed?
Yeah.
You know, as a, I don't know. Just thought that was definitely interesting. I kind of like the idea that there's no. Seemingly no, like, predominant internet culture, you know, like, maybe
there's no World Wide Web. I mean, it's not to say that there's not an internet of sort, but it's not,
it's probably still like on college campuses and, like, you know, still being used probably for databases.
In a very limited way.
But one thing I noticed when Judd goes to visit Roberta Sutton, the wife of the officer that gets shot. And, you know, she says that he liked you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he follows that up with, he likes me. Like, to state that, you know, present day or, you know, present tense, like, he's still alive. And I just thought it was interesting, you know, she has already accepted that he's dead.
Well, and that or she has a bone of contention with the lifestyle, say, of police officers or him as chief.
No. She, you know, I think the way that scene played out is she was talking about her husband as if he was dead, you know, and he was correcting her like he's still alive, you know, and it, on my first watch, I thought, cause I don't know, don't know what's happening. I don't know why this is happening. All, you know, all this stuff is coming at me for the first time. And I thought, did she tip someone off about her husband? And therefore, is she hiding something? You know, did she think something was going to happen and someone was going to kill her husband? So she had already in her mind decided, well, my husband's dead and I have to react as if I didn't know, or, you know, so that's, on the second watch, I don't feel that is the case. I truly, you know, don't think that she tipped off a white supremacist group that her you know, her husband is a cop. But on, like I said, on first watch, not really knowing what all was happening, I thought maybe she was aware, but, I think this is just a case of she's already accepting the worst when obviously, he's still alive, and Judd is just reminding her subtly, or, you know, softly, like, you know, he's still with us. So, so that is, you know, we do meet Angela next, and she's instructing this this class. You know, her son's in the class, and it's kind of a bring your parent to work or to school or career day sort of thing, because we find out that. Her cover, I guess, is that of a baker. So she's teaching kids about, you know, egg whites and proteins and what keeps the yolk together and this and that. And, of course, that's being, you know, we're hearing her talking about proteins and that they put up these walls and that without it, everything just comes tumbling down. And, of course, that's when we get our first glimpse of Mars and a certain blue character who resides on Mars, and, you know, we see Dr. Manhattan from a great distance. We see him, like, basically building this Martian sandcastle and just removing the walls, as she says this thing about walls and proteins. And, you know, once he removes the walls, then the structure can't be supported, and this big sandcastle just kind of collapses.
And then this is a fuzzy kind of image.
Yeah.
And it's of a screen, and the screen, I don't think we really see a back view, you know, a zoomed out view of this, but we see the little bit of graphics that are on the screen. There is the word streaming mentioned there, but that's not, I don't think, internet related, you know, it's.
Yeah. No, I think it just
means. If it is a tightly monitored and clamped down.
Yeah. I think it just means, this channel is like 24/7 streaming Mars.
Yeah. What Dr. Manhattan's doing.
It's based. Yeah. It's exactly a
reality
that.
Show.
Yeah.
Dr. Manhattan reality show.
It's kind of like the NASA channel. It's like, watch it. There's not much to see, you know, sometimes, but yeah.
Watch him take a shower.
We're naked.
No, wait, he's always naked.
We always get to see what he's doing, I guess. Huh. So I guess that's we find out, you know, that's what Dr. Manhattan's been up to. Presumably he's just been on Mars since 1985 and just is screwing around with sand or, you know, Martian soil and all that stuff. So really excited and looking forward to seeing what else comes of that. Then we get this. She goes into her backstory of being born in Vietnam and being a police officer over there and coming over here and opening a bakery after, you know, retiring after being wounded in the line of duty. And then they get this little kid. I think during our pilot or trailer episode, I think I mentioned that there's a kid that they cast in an undisclosed role that to me looked like a young Rorschach. Just because it was a redheaded kid with his face was covered in freckles, and that's this kid, like this little kid that says, "Did you buy your bakery with red Ferdations?" Which
I say that's a portmanteau of Redford and reparations.
Yes, yeah, totally. So then, you know, what that tells me is that I don't know if it's Tulsa in general or it made me feel like this area, this town of Tulsa is more of a that President Redford came in and kind of did like a reparations thing where
and because of the tragedy.
Here you go here and something that we'll hear later on when Judd is in the truck and he's listening to the radio. It's Senator Joe Keane.
And his son, Joe Jr.
Well, it's
is mentioned.
John Keane was the original. They call him Joe Jr. Oh. Yeah, but it's
so it
not like
a grandson.
No, I think it's the same. Yeah. I think it's his son, but I just don't think it's not literally a junior situation. It's just that's what they call him. But he's commenting on, you know, they took their land or they had to give up their land. They had to get told what animals they couldn't kill and that they had to wait 6 months for a gun. So just that comment of they took their land, I think that is what this is about, that, you know, land was taken from people and given back to, you know, people that obviously had been through this horrible event, or at least probably the descendants of people that had gone through this, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I think that's what I got from it. It sounds like you kind of got the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to point out additionally, I almost mentioned it earlier for the beginning part, of the riot happening, but, now's a good time, I think, too, is that, you know, on the Wikipedia page for Tulsa Race Riot at the bottom, there's a See Also section and there's the Jaybird Woodpecker War.
Okay.
There's the Ocoee Massacre. There's a Rosewood Massacre and the Wilmington Insurrection of 1898. So I would say those are four other city areas, what have you, that could have something done, probably all done, have these reparations enforced, you know.
And it could be like one particular area may have been more of a haven for people that were given this land and may not have been the entire city of Tulsa. But yeah, who knows? And then once, let's see. Oh, that's when we get the squid fall when she's driving her son Topher home And yeah, this siren starts going off, and you just get a squid rain shower, and it's the weirdest thing.
It's a normal thing,
yeah,
because they have the alarm for it.
Yeah,
they have the street cleaner for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she even has a special wiper inside her car that she brings out to wipe them off. And because I would assume that the cars just aren't the car manufacturers aren't doing normal windshield wipers right. that are strong enough for it. I just use a separate one.
Yeah, like I said, it was so weird, but it made me so happy. Just this idea of a squid fall. It's a regular thing, and I, you know, the only thing I can assume is that this is a byproduct of what Vite did with the whole squid thing, you know,
or at least that's what people want you to think.
Yeah,
is the other possibility that's floating out there. That's for darn sure.
Yeah, so it's fascinating, and I really like that it's a thing here, and it certainly makes the. Official art thing that they kind of showed way back in the production phase where you see kind of a squid drawing and like it's like a fallout shelter. So that certainly makes a lot more sense that it's not necessarily, you know, maybe it's not meant for large squid like we see in New York, but definitely these smaller ones. So I just love that that's the thing.
Well, if you've seen Magnolia...
Yeah,
and the effect of small squishy animals
yeah.
in driving conditions that can be bad.
Yeah,
you can run into a building that way.
That's when you
definitely want to pull over.
Yeah, yeah. So she goes home. She finds out from her husband that she left her pager, which we've already talked about, but pagers are still a thing. And she gets this message about Little Bighorn, and so that's kind of a reference to, you know, Custer's last stand, Little Bighorn, and then Custer's, the 7th Cavalry were a part of Custer's men. Like, that's who he commanded. So I guess it's a reference to Little Bighorn being a reference to this new 7th Cavalry, which I guess cavalry here in the show is spelled with a K. At least for this group.
Yeah, that's right. So that was the big. That was one of the crazy things that I found in the captions. I didn't catch that it would be the case.
Yeah,
because at one point he says, Judd says 7K.
Yeah,
I thought that was the only. Yeah. But I don't know what the way you figured it. Is that how you?
I'm just through websites. You know, talking about what, you know, Easter eggs and that sort of thing, and
sure.
So yeah, she goes to her bakery, which is closed. It's apparently perpetually opening soon.
Yeah, right.
And she even gets questioned about that by we see Louis Gossett Jr. and he's just almost giving her shit, like in that sort of tone, like, you know, is this place opening? And out of the blue asks her if she thinks he could lift 200 pounds, which definitely does not make sense, you know, until you get to the end of the episode. So,
still doesn't make a lot of sense because we'll find out more, I think, in the ensuing episodes.
Yeah. But at least it's a foreshadowing that he is up to something. He's planning to do something, you know, you find out later, but. Then to get her kind of a montage of her becoming Sister Knight, just this nun themed persona that she takes on, and as she goes out to kick some ass. And I mentioned it on our trailer episode that I just love her look here. It's so awesome. Got this long black leather duster, and I love the use of black paint to cover her eyes and you know, with the kind of cloth that she wears over the rest of her face, it's an awesome look. And then she gets in this sleek black car and just goes straight to, I guess it's called Nixonville, you know, it's kind of the, looks like it just full of like trailers and RVs, and it's You know, the one thing I noticed instantly was when you enter Nixonville, you see a lot of what I would call the American flag. But as we know in this Watchmen universe, you know, once the 51st state of Vietnam gets added, the flag changes. And, you know, it struck me that what we know as the American flag with 13 stripes and 50 stars kind of becomes a symbol of the white supremacy kind of people in Nixonville. So it's weird to think of our flag as being like a rebel flag. But yeah, it's this, these people, these white supremacists hold on to this flag as like, it's not our 51st state. The way
things should be.
Yeah. It's very time. Yeah. It's the same mentality that the assholes that say, how do they put it? Heritage, not hate, or something like that. When they try to justify the Confederate flag, it's that kind of crap. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting to see the flag that we know kind of, to me, kind of take on that role. And then on second viewing, the guy driving the truck at the beginning of the episode that shoots the cop, he's wearing a hat with, you know, the typical American flag kind of on it. So she pulls this guy out of his trailer and then cuts to
though, when she's pulling in, it's our first bit of similarity to the old book and movie.
Okay.
The spray painted little bit of, it's not so much used as vandalism, something disparaging towards Redford.
Right.
Redford something. I forget exactly, but
yeah, F. Redford.
Tip of the hat to who watches The Watchmen
being spray painted. Yeah. Graffiti kind of being used as I guess to get your message out there. I love that. I didn't really think about this until I watched it the third time, that she pulls into this this neighborhood and you see that people take notice of her. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, the car pulls up, you see the trunk pop just enough to be unlocked, and then she gets out, busts in the guy's door, and you see other people kind of, you know, neighbors close by, and then it cuts, you know, once she kicks in the door and punches the guy, it cuts to her, I think, pulling up to the police station. I like the thought of her dragging this guy out of his house, throwing him in the trunk, and these neighbors that I guess just watched. Mm-hmm. You know, it shows how tough she is that she can just do this and not be, I guess pull it off without anyone else getting in her way. So I like that. What do you got anything as far as some of this first stuff we get at the police station? Because I kind of jumped to when we...
Well, her sit down. She's sitting down in Judd's office with her feet up, and he asks her to, or tells her to get her feet down. She never does, but yeah. And supposedly, you know, the cup that she's drinking from is an owl cup.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning, you know, the blacked out eyes, around the eyes, and I think, you know, when she does have her the rest of her mask and hood, what have you, down, I think it's still kind of hard to tell who she is, you know. It's not as bad as Clark Kent with glasses, but
it's
similar to the Domino masks. Mm-hmm. That are popular among Robins and Ozymandiases.
We have Judd. He's addressing all the officers and kind of filling them in, and that's when they show this video. I guess the police were sent a video maybe from the 7th Cavalry, and it's them kind of outlining their plan, and they're just point blank, you know, talking about using Rorschach's words, you know, that we know from the book, from the movie, just, you know, looking up and shouting, "Save us," and we'll whisper no, and uh-huh. all the whores and politicians and so many other key words that we know, but it's Rorschach's words being perverted and twisted, right. you know, by these people that, you know, took what they thought Rorschach mm-hmm. stood for, and
which is very meta.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's just being twisted. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see that, you know. We went through the movie and we saw how, in many ways, how terrible Rorschach is because of the things that he believes, you know. But at his core, yeah, he's a hero for the most part. But then when you have these people, the Seventh Cavalry are using Rorschach as their mascot, it just hurts, you know? Like, you hate seeing what is a morally questionable person be the symbol for just morally repugnant people. But it makes total sense, you know, if, you know, in the world where his journal gets out and people know, you know, have his thoughts, yeah, if the wrong person reads those messages, they can twist those words into this belief structure, and yeah, so it totally tracks, and it makes sense where or how this group kind of got to be this way based on his journals and stuff. But I really like that. That's the theme for this group. You know, it works really well.
Mm-hmm. And I forget if I kind of brought this up, you know, in, especially like, say, like at the very end when he drops his journal through the slot,
right?
At the right wing, paper. You know, what would the Watchmen story, you know, it would change so drastically if you only get, you know, a very limited scope of things from the journal as to how things happened, what things went down according to this one guy. You know, that kind of a story could be interesting, but it could also be really, really, you know, be able to be taken and perverted in this way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's where we get to see Panda again, and also with the captions, I kept seeing the name in the credits and so forth, and in the lead up to this Pirate Jenny.
Oh yeah.
She's the one that speaks out, and then she comes back in for the flying.
Yeah, it took me the longest time to figure out if that was her or not. Mm-hmm. Because
she has a bit of a private look,
see now. It doesn't like
capture
it. It's not obvious right at the start, but yeah, once you see her later inside the owl ship or the airship, there are, you know, skull and crossbone type motif on like the bandana that she wears and stuff. So yeah, I was kind of keeping an eye out for her, and I think what struck me is that I've seen pictures of the actress that's playing her, and she typically has, you know, dark or like brown or dark black hair, and then this character has more blonde highlights than I was, I guess, expecting. So I didn't read like, oh, here's this blonde in kind of a mask. I didn't read that as the same actress, because for the most part her face is completely covered, so you can't get a great sense of who's portraying this Pirate Jenny. But yeah, that was cool to figure out that it was her. I'm for some reason I'm really excited to see this character, see what she's all about, just because I like the name. You know, it's a reference to the Nina Simone song, that the lyrics to the song Pirate Jenny talk about a black freighter, and so that, of course, you know, ties into the book and everything. So, and it's even,
yeah,
I think it's
one. Yeah, the song was on the official album release soundtrack, yet not used in the movie.
Yeah, it's a weird song, but just because of Nina Simone's voice, I think, and it's very spoken word, so it's more of like you're hearing a story. So let's see. Did you catch? I guess you had the subtitles, so you might have the answer. But Judd wraps up this meeting with...
He says, you know, the case custodiae,
episodes custodes, and I couldn't catch what they respond with, because it's all group chant, you know, group response, so it, the individual words kind of got lost on me, so I don't know if...
Yeah, I know it was there. I'm positive the response was there, too. Okay. I just didn't jot it down or anything.
Okay. Because it couldn't tell if they were saying something Latin or what, but we might...
No, yeah, I'm quite positive.
Okay.
Yeah, there's another Latin response.
Okay.
And But hey, we'll mention the Crime Busters Listener Society on Facebook, where I will, later this evening, I should post in there.
Yeah.
That little bit.
For sure.
Go back and look.
Let's see. So we get, you know, this guy that she's got in her trunk, Judd tells her to throw him in the pod, and that's where we get this really interesting interrogation sequence with Looking Glass. Mm-hmm. Just visually very interesting. You know, you've got this room that they're inside that is a kind of slideshow of various images that, you know, and he just is repeating, you know, asking about if he is aware of this group, the 7th Cavalry, and if he's, you know, does he associate with anybody, all that.
Yeah, he goes from one other type of question back to that question.
Yeah.
Again, repeated at least twice that we see.
Right.
Now, with his mirror face, and because this room is circular and has these images, you know, all around it. So essentially, I think the prisoner, terrorist, as he's called even too, and he denies, he's only going to be able to see, like, himself reflected, but whether it's on the walls in front of him that's behind Looking Glass, or it's in Looking Glass's face, he only sees those other images besides his own self image.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did read that it was all computer effects that they were just sitting in a room with no images because they needed to be able to put them all. They needed to be able to put the images in later because that's what was going to be reflecting off the masks. They needed to do it all as an effect shot. So,
Now in the second watch, for a moment I thought I saw Trump
said
it was Robert Redford when I backed it up a few seconds. Oh, wait a second. Okay. That's fine. That makes more sense.
Yeah. One of the things that stood out as to me, it felt more like a Watchmen movie reference than a book thing was, you know, once this interrogation's over, they're leading the guy outside, but instantly Sister Knight just takes the guy, like throws him into another room and just starts beating the crap out of him, which is what we hear. We don't see anything. And it's almost it's definitely a reference to Rorschach, and Big Figure in this little private bathroom where, you know, the water starts leaking out and then you get blood. And even then, when we had that moment in the movie, I remember talking about how it doesn't make sense how silently Rorschach was able to produce, you know, so much blood so quickly. Whereas here we hear her just beating the crap out of this guy. And so, you know, as she's asking him where he is or where, you know, they want to know where to find the 7th Cavalry. But here it's definitely more believable that she gets, you know, blood from this guy that we see coming out, you know, from underneath the door. So, like I said, to me, this reads more as a reference to the movie than
I did not think of it, but that's, yeah, I totally agree.
So I like that's that, you know,
yeah,
visually just a nice little nod, but, this time around it, there's no question of how did she get, this guy to bleed.
One of the other things she gets is this location.
Yeah, the cattle ranch.
Yeah, where at least the shooter is, but then also other cavalry members.
And this cattle ranch sequence, it's kind of the big action set piece of the episode, and I thought it was incredible. Mm-hmm. It's hard to watch all three times that I watched it, with the cows just being decimated by this 50 cow machine gun that is just destroying everything in its path, and you know they're doing what they can to take cover behind these the bodies of these cows and stuff, uh-huh. but they're just getting shredded, and it was very effective. But it's a great sequence. It took me the third viewing before I realized what Red Scare was doing. At a certain point, he's hiding behind something, and you see him throw something.
Yeah.
Anytime I see someone throw something, grenade, yeah. And so you see him throw it, and then you wait a few seconds, and there's no boom. So I'm uh-huh. thinking, where's the boom, from this grenade that he just tossed? And then it wasn't until the third watching that I realized that's where the smoke is all coming from. He's tossing out a smoke grenade or whatever. He's just trying to lay down some cover, because
that's what they needed.
Yeah, yeah. And
I kept shooting.
Yeah. I think the other times the smoke just reads to me as, shooting a gun that much, you're kicking up a lot of dust. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't dawn on me until that third time around that he was producing that smoke as a method of cover. So it makes total sense, but it just took me a few to realize. No, just a great action sequence. She finally gets her moment to charge this machine gun nest once he needs to, once the shooter is, replacing or adding a new cartridge or whatever, reloading.
Yeah.
She takes her opportunity to just go kick some ass and takes out one of them right away, shoots one of them, and then has a tussle with the next one, who she chases inside this building. Meanwhile, I think we have two more people who are getting into a plane.
A plane that we see Judd and Pyrogeny up in this. We'll talk about in a little bit, I think. Yeah. But the cover approaching it, there's a covering over part of the plane, but not certainly all of it. So it's almost like it's too bad they couldn't tell that was a plane underneath.
Yeah,
that
apparently before, just enough to throw off.
They're all surprised.
Yeah, yeah. So it I realized, I think at a certain point when this guy that she's chasing, when he's still in the bed of the truck. Mm-hmm. It might be when he's assisting with the reloading of the gun. I see his hat. He's got the little American flag badge on his hat. And I thought, oh, it looks like the same as the guy in the truck from the beginning of the episode. And then once you follow this into the building, and she's fighting with the guy, and she gets him on the floor, and he takes this cyanide capsule. It was. First time was a little hard for me to tell because the guy was laying flat on his back, and so your face looks different when you're laying flat as opposed to when you see someone sitting in a truck. But it is the same guy. The guy that shoots the cop at the very beginning of the episode is now killing himself with cyanide here in this fight. So,
there was the moment prior where they're divvying up the
these
cyanide pill capsules, what have you.
Yeah, right after this really cool sequence of them taking apart watches and all this stuff, collecting all these batteries, and so we'll have to wait to see what that's gonna be later. I mean, the bag of watch batteries that they are producing here does get it goes down with the plane that we'll see them shoot down. So, but I'm sure that other little cells, terrorist cells, are probably doing the same thing. So that's a little dangling thread that I think we'll get an answer to later. let's see. Yeah. So the plane takes off, and then that's when she says that, when Angela says they've got a plane, they're under you. And I think this point, I even knew that the police had an airship, but it didn't occur to me until she said they're under you that Judd and Pirate Jenny are in the air. You know, they're stationary. They must just be hovering. And that's when I got really excited. So excuse me. I made no attempt to hide my love for Archie and the owl ship in when we covered the movie. And here I'm so tickled that the police have their own airship. And that was interesting because I saw, you know, several places online, or tweets that, you know, how did the police get the owl ship, or where's Night Owl? If, you know, how did he lose the owl ship? Like it, because to me, this doesn't read as Archie. This, right. This reads as,
oh, no, it would have to be extremely heavily modified. I mean,
right.
There is the idea that you can, you can take apart a ship, replace a part of it, you know, to do that. Is it still the same ship or not?
This one doesn't, to me, does not look like a modified Archie. It looks like, you know, in the 30 years that have taken place, you know, Dan's plans have gotten stolen, or maybe he gave plans to the police, or somehow Dan's, you know, Archie plans have gotten out there and the police have adopted the technology and they use them for their airships. Like, it totally made sense to me. Like, this isn't Archie. This is just something based on Archie. And regardless, I love it. I love that the police have Archie inspired airships. Really happy to see it. And of course it doesn't last very long, but I'm assuming that this isn't the only airship that the police have. That'll remain to be seen, you know, but, I just love the that it's here at all. I love, so, let's see. So we do have, that's when we cut to, do we want to go to Wales?
Sure. I think we're going to get two or three total of these scenes here. So just two. Maybe.
What do you mean?
Well, we at the very end, or not not the very end, much closer to the end. I think we come back to here, or is it just one long scene here, or like three?
I'm talking about, like, I think this is when it transitions to Jeremy Irons, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay. So, it kind of transitions to this. Actually, it's a really clever way they do it because it's like, we're seeing the starry sky and then that kind of fades and transitions into, you know, it's the coastline of, I know they're filmed in Wales. I don't know if setting for the story, I don't know if it's set in Wales, but regardless, it's like the black starry sky transitions into like the sea, I guess. And the coastline. So, and then you see, you know, guy Jeremy Irons riding this horse, and it's funny because one of the sites that I was glancing at earlier today, you know, said that maybe one of the Easter eggs here is that Death rides a pale horse, which, you know, is one of the things that I wouldn't shut up about when we talked about in the movie, the references to, you know, to death being, you know, death coming and that sort of thing. So it is, maybe it's intentional. Here's, you know, having Jeremy Irons' character riding this pale horse. And, you know, does that mean he's Death? You know, I don't know. But yeah, we have him riding up to his castle, I guess. And, you know, he's got some servants about, you know, there's, you know, he gets into his room, I don't know, one of the rooms, and he's sitting down at this typewriter, and then you see that he's naked and getting this like massage from Miss Crookshanks. So, you know, and the massage is related to him writing and having like sore muscles or stiff muscles from And then that's when he gets Mr. Phillips comes up and offers to dress him in, I don't know, this, I guess, formal wear.
Because of an anniversary.
Yeah. So we don't know what the anniversary is for. I think it's established that it's like the 1 year anniversary, or am I making that up? It's certainly there's yeah, one right. candle on that the, on the cake, but I don't think.
Yeah.
You would think. So we're not exactly sure what the anniversary is for, and you know this is kind of one of the big mysteries of this episode and this series is who the hell is this yeah. character? Is it Adrian Veidt? You know, it certainly seemed that way in the lead up to the show. Everyone just assumed that Jeremy Irons is playing, yeah. you know, an older Adrian Veidt.
And the marketing is playing very coy with
yeah.
who it might be with that.
It's yeah.
You know who he is.
Interesting because, like, IMDb mm-hmm. credits him as Adrian Veidt / Ozymandias. I'm not certain at this point if HBO has confirmed his identity. I'm pretty sure they have not said who he's officially mm-hmm. playing. So someone is either, I guess IMDb is just assuming. But yeah, and just based on the dialogue and what's going on and these weird servants that this character has, you know, it certainly seems like this could be John Osterman, Dr. Manhattan. You know, in maybe the 1 year anniversary is him, like his first anniversary at this new life mm-hmm. that he's created. And this is him trying to become human again. Are the servants, you know, people? Are they robots? Are they, you know,
do anniversaries they have to be based around a year, right? You can't have an anniversary
if
for
you
one
break
day,
down do you, the I mean I don't know I don't know how that works because the root of the word yeah. is like yeah. is yeah. it means like 1 year or you know mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know
because I mean we're at this castle, you know, looking place, and we saw Dr. Manhattan on Mars trying to build a castle. Seemingly.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The thing with these servants, I mean, together, especially the guy, the butler character, I mean, you know, he served the cake, and instead of a knife, he brings out a horseshoe. They're both metal, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Good try.
Yeah, it's like, And he kind of says, you know, that's a horseshoe, Mr. Phillips. And you can see Phillips, like, the look on his face is like, oh, I messed up mm-hmm. or I did a bad thing, or like he's confused. He's not sure, you know, it's such a weird reaction that this guy certainly does not appear to be mm-hmm. human, or if he is, he's as good of a human creation as if this is Manhattan, right. you know, was able to create, you know, it's like, who knows?
What Manhattan or Adrian Veidt. You know, either one of them could be trying to create.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, this could be the real Adrian playing with, creating life. I mean, he certainly
did with Bubastis.
Created Bubastis. Yeah, yeah. Maybe this is his attempt at creating humans. So, of course, Dave Palace over in the Facebook group won't shut up about this being Westworld. So, well, I guess we'll see. Yeah, get this Westworld Watchmen crossover.
So the other part of this, then he then gives the Lord, the Master, his yeah. this gift wrapped in fur.
Mm. Yeah.
And the Master, he unwraps it, and it's a watch that the guy says he's created from old blueprints.
Yeah, and it's a nice little scene, and it truly does like you can see that it touches. The Lord, right. I don't know what to call him. So, but yeah, that's like he's truly like appreciative of this gift, you know.
Yeah, and the captions very successfully don't indicate a name. Just
yeah,
it's only in what people call him, Lord and Master. Those two things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's how like the synopsis on IMDb even says mm-hmm. the Lord of a country estate. Receives an anniversary gift from his loyal servants. So, and apparently this cake that they've yeah, made for him must taste horrible.
Yeah. Takes one bite.
I do like how he plays that reaction, like just this, you know, the looks that he's giving and he's hiding it as best he can. So I do like that.
So, well, Alfred, now you know how it feels to be a butler or to be a master with a butler.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Then it transitions to.
We want
to
talk about him saying that he's written a play or he started writing a play.
Oh,
five acts,
oh, yeah.
And he wants the two of them to be the leads, lead actors.
In yeah, them. Which tells me that he's very limited in who he has around him. If these two are his best options for the lead roles. Then that tells me that if this is Adrian, then I think he's here on this estate and can't leave. And therefore he only has like his resources are limited. Like the only people that he has available are the ones that are here. So he has to make the best I guess these are the best two options as far as the leads for his play. Because maybe he just doesn't have access to the rest of the world. That's my initial take. That's just speculation.
And the name of the play is The Watchmaker's Son.
Yes, yeah, which obviously makes you instantly think of John Osterman. He was the son of a watchmaker. So, kind of, is this Adrian writing a play about John Osterman? Is this John Osterman writing a, biographical or autobiographical story about himself? Like, it's so mysterious, which is to be expected. This is Damon Lindelof, and this one is a fun mystery. Like, I'm not frustrated at this. I'm pleasantly like intrigued by all this. So I think this will be a kind of a fun thing to discover, I guess. But I think that's when it does kind of feel like a weird transition because you get, there have been hints of this, TV series that's being promoted on TV and on bus ads and a couple other places, I think. And we have this... it's like a preview or like a teaser for this, what's it called? Heroes in America?
American Hero Story.
American Hero
Story. Kind of similar to American Crime Story. I think it's a play on that, maybe.
Yeah.
But then subtitled Minutemen.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like they're focusing mostly on Hooded Justice.
Yeah.
He's certainly the one that they have on the bus ads and everything. And then this little animated kind of teaser, it tracks through most of the Minutemen characters until it like finds Hooded Justice at the head of the table. And the one thing that jumped out at me seeing this, and it's a animated rendition of the Minutemen characters, but you're only seeing them as if they're standing next to this big conference table, like as it's like part of their their hideout. It's like as if they're all standing around this table. And so the reflections that you get Captain Metropolis and then Comedian, Mothman, Dollar Bill, Silk Spectre. And I think that's it. And then it goes to Hooded Justice, who's like standing at the end of the table. But, the first time I watched this and I'm 90% sure, 95% sure that at least for Captain Metropolis, Mothman, and Dollar Bill, they're using the Zack Snyder shot versions of those characters. If you look at the reflection, and that's all we see of Captain Metropolis and Mothman, I promise you those are the actors from Zack Snyder's Watchmen. As those characters and they're just using, their images, they're flipping them upside down and making them, turning them into reflections and doing a filter to make them look animated. I don't know that they used, the Jeffrey Dean Morgan Comedian and Carla Gugino's Silk Spectre. Like they kind of look different enough. And maybe that's a, a rights thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe we're going to see them so later on in the series. So maybe they didn't want to use other actors' likenesses. I don't know. But as far as the other characters, I am, like I said, I'm convinced that they used the Snyder film footage for those characters. So, which makes sense. I mean, it's perfectly seems that it seems like that stuff is at their disposal, mm-hmm. Disposal. So,
well, and then the other thing with Hood of Justice is that, that's what we got from the Comic-Con trailer, mm-hmm. what have you, that there's a decent, possibly length scene, which apparently is from the,
mm-hmm.
from the show. It's similar to this being shown,
like the recreation
and
kind of
it's
thing
being shown on the TV in Judd and Jane's house.
Yeah. Yeah. He's on the phone to the governor, I guess, kind of explaining the situation and, that their response to the cavalry-initiated, that they had to escalate it by taking down this terrorist cell and all that. So, and then he says he's going to go into town and go to the hospital or go, I guess, to their medical facility to visit with Sutton. And here's where things started to get really weird for me, going through the first time. Because you have him putting on his uniform, and then the music starts to dramatically shift. And I start to think, oh no, he's a bad guy. And this is going to be the reveal of Judd as the villain of the story. I think, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking he's going to the hospital so that he can finish the job and make sure Sutton dies. And then as the music starts to change, the focus shifts and you see this image of what I assume is Judd as a young boy sitting on his dad's lap. And his dad is dressed in a similar police uniform. Like maybe his dad is also the chief of police. Either way, I'm just assuming this is Judd and his father. And his father is definitely a police officer as well. And just from the tone and the way the focus shifts, like it indicates that is telling us something, but I don't know what. Because it's not like they shifted the focus and revealed a picture of Judd with a bunch of other people that we know to be white supremacists, which is what I was expecting once they started to reveal the photo. I was thinking that we're going to find a picture of him with someone recognizable. It was the only part of the episode that felt really odd and out of place for me. Because as this tone shifted, I think, okay, this is telling us something, but I don't know what, And so it's like they play it like it's a reveal. But whereas I guess what it really is just it's foreshadowing maybe for something later. But it's like it leaned too far into reveal than foreshadow, because this music continues to be creepy and he's leaving this, little compound that he lives on and heads into town. He tells his wife that they're going to drive him, even though we see him driving himself. And then, it leads to, we've got kind of as this is happening, we have him running over like a spike strip and someone is kind of ambushing him as he gets out of his truck. And then there's this bright light and then it cuts to Angela and her husband. They're having sex, trying not to answer the phone until they finish. And then, she answers the phone. And then it's like you talked about it earlier, whose voice we hear on the phone. I total agreement. I think this is Will calling her and saying that, basically telling her to meet him alone and
not wear a mask,
indicating that
because he knows who
she is. Don't wear the mask
and her father's name.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then that's when we have her driving.
She busts out the gun from the headboard behind, secreted in the headboard, And then another gun that she gives, she takes that one, but the other one she pulls from the inside the fireplace and gives to her husband.
Yeah.
And tells her about, tells him about being careful and shooting anyone that's not her that comes up the street onto the porch.
So. Yeah. And I think the way I read the scene with them when, you know, at the beginning of the episode when he gives her the pager and asks her about Little Bighorn, like it reads as he doesn't know she's a cop. Or at least doesn't know that she's a
badass cop.
A super cop. Yeah. And so I think I just assumed that he thought she was legitimately a baker, but when he certainly seems to be in on it once she hands him the gun, he's not like shocked and surprised and confused. So maybe he's completely aware of what she does, but doesn't know the particulars, you know, doesn't know the what Little Bighorn means and things like that. But it's certainly this later scene, you know, seems like he's aware at least that she still works with the police. So, she tells him just to blast anybody that's not her, basically, that comes up the street. So, and then that's where we get her going to meet up with Will and finds Judd hanging from a tree, dead. So, quite a shock, I think.
Quite a
surprise for this series. I mean, we not surprised that the first episode leaves us with a big cliffhanger and surprise, but
I wasn't
expecting,
you know,
this.
There's not a matter of, you know, oh, they only had Don Johnson listed for being in one episode, you know. And, and you can cut this out if you want, but on one of the two podcasts, on one of them, person that has seen six out of the nine episodes says it's flashbacks that we see him in more.
Okay. That's at a certain point, and we kind of jumped over the sequence of them all having dinner together with Judd and his wife and Angela and Cal.
Judd snorts a little something. Everything.
Doing a little bump.
And his wife is a little upset with that, seemingly later, in between those two calls, what have you. You want to call him?
There was a moment there once he was, I don't know if it was when he was singing or what, that it started to occur to me, and this sometimes happens in movies or other shows, it's like for whatever reason, it dawned on me that everything that we had seen of Don Johnson's character, Judd, at this point, had in trailers and in TV spots and all the various clips had already happened. And so, you know, I don't always clue into that sort of thing, but for some reason I did this time. I thought, okay, he might die. once he says he's going to visit Sutton in the hospital, then I think it's a villain reveal and he's going to be around for a long time. So at that point, I kind of had flip-flopped on that, thinking he was going to die. So it was, to me, a genuine surprise to see him dead in that hanging from that tree. So, and, of course, it is revealed that Louis Gossett Jr., he has this paper that his father had written at the very start of the episode, you know, watch over the boy. And at least seemingly, it definitely seems that this is the same person, you know, this is Will Reeves, and he was the young boy, and I don't know if this is, you know, obviously we don't know the reason here. I mean, is this something that Will orchestrated, taking revenge for, or anything that happened to him as a child, you know, or is this, we just don't know.
So then the song is playing. That's playing as "Poor Judd is Dead" from Oklahoma.
Yep.
So we essentially get three different songs from Oklahoma throughout. Three. And in it, the lyric that we hear is the title.
Yeah.
Near the end of the song.
And did you catch the drop of blood dropping onto his sheriff star or chief, whatever his badge is? It you know. Very familiar drop of blood. I didn't catch the first time. I saw it on the second watch. But yeah, a little nod to the comedian's badge, drop of blood, and
yeah, I can't say I actually saw the blood hit it, but I just knew it did. It's just, you know, it's like, sure. Oh, it's obvious there. He's just making this similar, yeah. this badge be similar to,
yeah,
comedian's badge in a sense, the button. Yep.
Trying to go through, see if I have any other little notes that
I'd like to point out. If hopefully we'll see it some more. I believe per the trailer we'll see it at least once more. The bakery, and it was downstairs, and I think we should just call that the Nun Cave.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely. I think this pilot, it lives up to the hype. You know, we've been waiting for this series, you know, obviously since they announced it, and then it felt like there was such a long span of time with nothing, you know, no, like, are they filming? Are they getting close to airing anything? Like, it just, we went so long without casting information, without, like,
yeah, so often, so much can just die on the vine at that point,
yeah.
You know, when you're not hearing anything,
yeah.
Usually, it seems like. I couldn't tell you how many times I happen to be looking at Wikipedia pages and I see an indication that, oh, this show is being worked on, and it turns out it's from 2014. It's like, son of a,
yeah.
It's 2019, it's 5 years later now.
You think, whatever happened to that?
It's probably not going to happen.
Yeah. But now, for me, yeah, it definitely, it intrigued me enough with enough little things, and it gave me enough little threads that I'm really excited to see what happens with, you know, the whole, obviously the big part of it, I guess, is the police versus the 7th Cavalry. And then I can't wait to see more Dr. Manhattan stuff.
Well, and I'm really ready for, because of Judd dying in this weird way too.
Right.
You know, seemingly killed, you know, that I believe that would be what brings the FBI agent Lori Blake, played by James Bond.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I hope she's Silk Spectre, Lori. Just basic.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's funny. It's like, and once you get into this episode, you forget that you don't even meet everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's good that they're saving her for an episode two, you know, pretty mm-hmm. sure, that we'll meet her in the next episode. But I kind of like that. Like, just save a little bit of stuff, you know, for the, that's kind of seems to be common with, you know, at least series premieres is like, it's usually more like two episodes until you meet everybody. And I'm okay with that. Like, I'm, they gave us so much already that I think it's okay to wait until the second episode to meet her. And there'll be a couple other characters I know that we'll meet later on, but.
Well, and one last thing this episode specifically, I mean, I would imagine that more of this ought to be, you know, brought up. I mean, it's this whole thing. I mean, how it starts with, you know, this awful event, in Tulsa that really happened in 1921 there. But, and the whole idea with this being this alternate universe, which we've certainly dealt with plenty before between the book and the movie. But in this instance, we have this African-American woman and her husband, and they seemingly have adopted three white kids.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, there's a reason for that. There has to be.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's just not, you know, I have a cousin and his wife that have adopted, you know, a little African-American boy and then a little Hispanic boy. But it just seems like it's so odd that this alternate universe is this way about things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you're right. That was definitely, there's a reason, I'm sure, for that. Or the reason itself is that, you know, this shouldn't seem odd.
Right, yeah, it shouldn't.
I mean, and it's not really odd.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that's the point, is that in this world, you know, I'm really fascinated with what Damon Lindelof and I guess director Nicole Cassell, what they've brought to us here. So definitely looking forward to more. And I watched the it's not really a next episode preview. Sure, it said like in coming weeks. So I think it's a montage of several weeks or several episodes, I think. So
and maybe half of it that we've seen before. All two or three or four of the teasers and trailers.
I think the big takeaway for me is what I guess would be, I'm sure, the initial conversation between Sister Knight and or Angela and Louis Gossett Jr.'s character,
But you know, so. I'd say, you know, watching many different serialized shows that you know, it's I think it's very likely you're not going to get that right off the bat. It's going to be a third of the way in, maybe.
Oh, sure.
To the next episode,
could be before we see them again. Some other
craziness happening.
Certainly, yeah, possible. I think here at the end of the episodes we can maybe just reveal what the next episode is going to be titled, if that's okay with you. So episode 2, it will be Martial Feats of Comanche Horsemanship. So I have no idea if that's another lyric from an Oklahoma song, or I'm not sure what that is. So I'm not going to search that episode title, and you know, I'm just going to wait until it's revealed in the episode, because I don't want to spoil myself. So, but I think that's all I've got.
Yep.
I guess why don't you tell everyone listeners who are familiar with us, but more importantly, you know, the maybe people who are new to us, like where else can they find you? What else are you got? What else are you working
on? Yeah, so as I mentioned at the top, Almost Famous Minute. So it's very similar to what Watchmen Minute did. I will be going from 3 a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday release, to once a week here in December. But then also Feels Like Weezer, and it seems to be something of a cousin to the movie by minute type. Alphabetical certainly did it first. Or did it best, in my opinion, too. But ABCDO was another great one. But Feels Like Weezer, going through all of Weezer's catalog, song by song, in chronological per release order. So I got those couple shows, and we're doing this again. So I'm at 3 right now.
Yeah.
3 yeah. coming out all at the same time.
And listeners can find me over on my regular podcast, Real Comic Heroes, where we chronologically go through comic book movies. We started in the 50s with Superman and the Mole Men, and we're, as of this episode, we are all the way up to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from 1990 is going to be our next episode, and that'll actually be released just a couple days after this episode goes out. And then after that, we'll have Back to the Future 3 coming up soon as well. So we're in the 90s with that podcast. And then let's see, what else do I have going on? I have announced, and my next Movies by Minutes project will be Iron Giant Minute. So I'm working on all the setup stuff over there, getting everything behind the scenes, getting working on that. And that'll be a 2020 release, probably mid to late 2020. So stay tuned for more of that. But that's all I got for now. But we will be back, you know, next week with episode 2. What was it again? Martial Feats of Comanche Horsemanship on Watchmen Minute. So until then, who watches the Watchmen?
We do.
We do.
What are you two talking about?
Oh, nothing.
Just the end of the world.
Just run and escape. Afraid to lose.
Is there life on Mars?